Welcome back, everyone. Today we have a very special guest, an expert in cybersecurity, in blockchain, in crypto, and also a dear friend of mine.
How many jurisdictions can say that they have sovereign wealth funds actually been deployed 9 digits plus into Bitcoin? You know, well, I mean, yes, we see the US is getting there, is announcing there, is.
I think the US is getting there, and we're pretty happy that this big change has happened.
The craziest part of, I mean, for me, the whole story is that they, in the code, in the script, the Bybit multisig wallet was hard-coded. So this was a deliberate attack. It's like many, this script could have been downloaded for by thousands, you know, millions of people that use that website. But they deliberately target, there was a surgical attack into the Bybit exchange because they had the largest. Now, on full disclaimer, have to do it. This could have happened to anybody.
So how do you get into that server? Because this is a very sophisticated hack to identify that the weak point is not in the smart contracts. It's not even in the nano ledgers, but it's actually in the centralized server that is displaying the website to the
hosting
wider public.
The UI,
hosting, literally.
The US.
So one experience. Question for me is like, how can that happen? And does it mean that the Lazarus group were inside their centralized server maybe for months or weeks trying to understand what's happening there?
Yeah. They download it and then they have control. What starts happening is whatever those scripts, files, viruses, whatever you want to call them, start looking at your computer. It starts inspecting. What it's most likely, or what we know right now that it is the case, is that this particular developer had production keys to access the AWS S3 bucket, which was where the hosting server, and then they were able to push code into the production. The very scary part, if you are following what I'm saying so far, is that means that Lazarus Group was able to push to one of the most used interfaces for the Safe Wallet to anybody.
Today, you will really enjoy our show because you will get a masterclass in Bybit hack. You will understand in detail what happened. How did the Lazarus Group infiltrate the wallet? How did they actually manage to hack and steal the biggest amount in history? But also, you will understand it what happened from the business side. You will also hear more about how custody is managed in the region, but also globally. And you will have a blast on today's podcast. I want to welcome our dear guest and a dear friend, Jose Aguinag, the CEO of Tungsten, one of the leading organizations here in the region. Welcome, everyone. My name is Anton Golub, and I'm here today with my co-host, Dr. Demetrio Zamboglu. You're going to love this show. Yeah, I think so. To start very strongly, then, we have a very... I think a very big event for the whole crypto industry that, Jose, you and I discussed actually over a beautiful brunch on Saturday, which is the Bybit hack. I think by amount stolen, the biggest hack in history, crypto history. So
wait a second. You guys had lunch without me?
Brunch.
Brunch.
We will not have lunch without you, but brunch, it's...
Again, I was not invited.
Yes, sometimes, you know, it's... but you will get the invitation next time. But it was a very interesting discussion because we talked... I mean, you had some very, very strong thoughts and really a pleasure then to have you today here as an expert. Cybersecurity, custody, crypto infrastructure. So what is your take, your provocative opinion about it? I know you were very venting a lot during our brunch.
Yes,
so kick it off. I want everybody to hear it. Yeah,
that is true. And, you know, thank you for bringing the very unfortunate events that happened very recently in the industry. Because I think the reality is that it not only affected Bybit as an exchange, but it had impact across the entire ecosystem, right? By you mentioning correctly, it was the biggest hack by all. And how that signals to not only well-seasoned players, but also externals that are looking at the industry, it's of course monumental, right? So running a qualified custodian, I of course have a strong opinions on how not only the hack was executed, I still think that a lot of people do not understand the mechanics of how it happened. I still engage with multiple individuals that, you know, maybe they brush it off, the complexity of the issue. However, coming from a regulated, you know, ecosystem, you know, working with enterprises, large institutions, it is fundamental that we know what happened, how do we avoid it for it happening, and what it actually means, right? Mm-hmm. So for us, infrastructure-wise, technically-wise, it's extremely important to understand, and, you know, we can go into more details on how it happened, and, you know, I can expand in any direction that you want.
What I want you to explain to our audience is the following. Maybe you can create a nice scenario. So you imagine the CEO of Bybit sitting on the desk and trying to sign in. Maybe if you can tell this story, how you imagine it from his side, then it will be much easier for our audience to understand it.
Yes. I think what, and you know, kudos to the Bybit being and Bybit team and to Ben for the quick reaction on kind of like a public communications perspective. Because what they saw, what they witnessed that evening was actually extremely stressful, because for them it was just a normal procedure, right? So imagine you're on your desk, you have your computer open, computer which, by the way, you know, goes under traditional security practices, has, you know, a team on top of them. So, you know, you can imagine Bybit is by no means a small company nor an amateur in any way or form, right? So they are doing traditional operational hygiene. They have what it's called a multisig, right? And, you know, if you are with a crypto ecosystem, you know, a multisig usually means you have multiple parties, as the name it says, that it's required in order to move assets. And one of the most well-known tools or multisigs in the Ethereum ecosystem, it's called a safe wallet. And the safe wallet, it's a smart contract usually deployed in the Ethereum blockchain, although there's in any other EVM compatible networks. And it is then being assigned a signatory capacity to one, two, or more people, right?
Can I just ask, sure. Does it mean that everybody who is supposed to sign has to sign, or is the majority? What's the experience? What do you think, like, that happened, or was actually the standard in the industry like?
So it is very, in a multisig, you can configure in anywhere form. You can actually today, if you go, you know, do you want to deploy what it's called a safe vault or like a safe wallet instance, you can do what it's called one of one. Multisig ecosystem, you lingo, so to speak, you use M out of N. So it's kind of saying you can have a subset of people that are actually signing a transaction. So industry standard for a small treasury amount, you have, for instance, three people that are part of your multisig, and you only need two people. It's kind of a very common industry standard. So that way, if someone is not available, if you need to do some changes, you need a rotation of personnel, you can then do it in somewhere form. Now, usually there's more or bigger configurations. You can have a 5 out of 7, 7 out of 10, one out of two. If you're managing a personal wallet, you can have, for instance, your own wallet, and then, you know, you have two wallets and you deploy a safe. Now, in this particular case, I believe, I might be mistaken, they had at least three signers that had to actually do it. One of them, the last one being, of course, Ben, the CEO. And just to clarify, this is a standard procedure. They were doing it on and on and on. Nothing happened. They checked their Nano ledgers. And when the moment they signed the Nano ledger, actually what they were doing is pretty much will be replacing the control of the wallet that was managing this 1.5 billion plus into someone else that now today we know is part of the Lazarus Group, one of the rogue offensives, you know, nations that are, you know, groups that are trying to, you know, constantly are attacking the crypto industry, that they are responsible for multiple hacks in multiple bridges in multiple networks. Akin to that, and you know, Dimitris, you made a good question. It's like, what it's akin to that, right? So imagine you are, you put all your money, let's say, you know, 1.5 billion, 2 billion, whatever you're going to say, behind a room with a lock key, right? And for opening that key, you need three keys, right? So imagine you have one of these complex, fancy locks, you need to put, you know, three keys to open that, right? The nature of this hack, what it managed to do is, they actually, when they put the three keys, rather than actually unlocking the actual door to be able to put the money, they gave the lock to someone else. And then any controls, any previous key, nothing that worked. Pretty much is just say like, hey, I'm going to remove the lock and I'm going to someone else. And that someone else was the Lazarus Group, unlocked the door, opened the door and took all the money.
So there is no scenario that they knew what they were doing.
That is correct. The hack relying in two parts. The first one, and this is what you mentioned, they use these nano ledger devices that have a small screen that show hexadecimal characters that are not human readable. So they not, this is what it's called blind signing. They don't have the ability to actually see what they are signing, but it gives them the capabilities to grant rights to this multisig. Because they have done it multiple times, because the procedures are well known, because their computers look fine, the UX look fine, the URL how they consume look fine, there was under no suspicion that something went wrong. And but the that's a first part, that what they were doing they couldn't see. But what in reality, and this is the other part of the hack, is the supply chain. So what they actually use to interact with this multisig, with this smart contract, was a website that is provisioned or that is managed by a third party company, which is called Safe. Safe Wallet, right? So this is a team, very skilled team based in Switzerland, great guys that are that have been working on this project for years. But the reality is that they got hacked. One of the developers that was responsible in this website got a key compromise that allowed the hackers to then inject into their website a code, a malicious code that allowed to trick all the Bybit members into signing and handing over this lock. And because the Bybit, the Nano Ledger wallets was not able to see, because the transaction was there, the data was there, then it was not possible for them to see that they were actually handing over that lock, right? So that was the important part to understand the Bybit hacks. It was a two-pronged attack. It relied on two critical parts. The first one is that the most common interaction in the multisig in the Ethereum world for wallets is using nano ledger devices that are unable to provide human readable data. And the first part is that the supply chain, the Bybit used to actually manage this interface, was by a third party that, for unfortunate reasons, didn't have enough security controls to protect that part of the system.
Maybe also just to also dive a bit deeper into the nuance. So we had the smart contracts from Safe, from Gnosis, which are battle-tested, managing billions and billions of dollars. Then we have a centralized server, which shows us the UX, shows us the website. And then we have the nano ledgers, the unfortunate ones at the end, where you can't see what you're signing. So the hack, quote unquote, happened in the centralized, I guess, AWS server or something similar. I have a question then around that. How can that happen? So how do you get into that server? Because this is a very sophisticated hack to identify that the weak point is not in the smart contracts. It's not even in the nano ledgers, but it's actually in the centralized server that is displaying the website to the wider public.
Hosting the UI.
So one experience. Question for me is like, how can that happen? And does it mean that the Lazarus Group were inside their centralized server maybe for months or weeks trying to understand what's happening there? Can you dive a bit deeper there?
For sure. So the quick answer to the question is two words, which is social engineering. Nowadays, think about the safest vault in the world. You're never gonna break it. You know this kind of like James Bond like movies that people are trying to use in these thousand tools. That never works, right? What it actually works is tricking the guard into opening the vault for you, into actually doing something that they think that they're actually doing in a possibly way, and actually you are tricking the guard, right? So social engineering is this. This sort of attack that tries to target the weakest link of most operational security, which is the people, right? So the way, and you know, we know nowadays that most of how the social engineer attacks works, particularly by the pattern we've seen from Lazarus Group, is they approach employees in these cyber crypto organizations. They pretend to be recruiters. They pretend to be, headhunters. they prompt them, they give them, you know, some interesting offer, they engage in conversation, tell them like, hey, we're, you know, we're offering you a job that is usually way above, you know, market rate. So, you know, just to wake up some interest from these people, and then send them PDF files or links that actually have malicious scripts that are usually undetected by the traditional security system of
so
the companies.
So a PDF might have malicious link.
For sure. A PDF might have actually very, very compromising information. That's why, you know, you see also an uprise on, you know, the sort of distribution of documents via DocSend or, you know, other things. Because the reality is when you download something to your computer, in an enterprise, you usually have managed endpoints which have security systems that are able to detect, right? But in, for the average person, it's you know, can be infected. You have no idea.
So the what does the average person need to have in his computer to be able to accept a PDF or a Word file and make sure that it's not infiltrated?
Yes. So what is very good is that nowadays there are tools that allow you to upload or kind of like redirect a PDF to be if it's malicious in some way or form. So if someone is sharing a file that it is, you know, that it comes from an unknown or untrusted version, you can upload it to a website it's able to identify. A lot of tools nowadays allow you to visualize
but
the content.
But in order to upload it, first you need to download it.
No, you can provide like a URL, right? So for instance, a lot of people use things like Google Drive or, you know, if you use a cloud service that you're able to kind of like put the PDF file without downloading in your workstation, usually these systems can actually detect some viruses. Funny enough, if you send an email by Gmail, Gmail actually will have this kind of like antivirus capacity and will be like, oh, okay. But whenever you download something in your workstation, you actually are inviting someone to you know, hack your system and hide your point.
So for our audience, if a recruiter is sending you an email, just use Gmail and make sure you receive the the PDF there.
Exactly, right? And that's the problem. LinkedIn has this messaging platform where they send you URLs. They don't check those URLs. Mm. They send you PDFs. They don't check those PDFs, and you can download it, right? So it's a very well-documented attack vector that most people, you know, that you know within the cybersecurity industry, we can identify. And Anto, to your original question, how do they get it? That's how they got it. They managed to trick, very likely. We don't fully know the whether that is the case, but knowing the history, it's very likely they approach a developer the same way that, you know, if you go to LinkedIn, you go and see the people that are employed at a company, you can double click in that person. That person is working that company. They approach him on email, send them a message, send them a PDF with, like, you know, or a URL with a malicious artifact. They download it and then they have control. What it starts happening is whatever those scripts, files, viruses, whatever you want to call them, start looking at your computer. It starts inspecting. What it's most likely, or what we know right now that it is the case, is that this particular developer had production keys to access the AWS S3 bucket, which was where the hosting server, and then they were able to push code into the production. The very scary part, if you are following what I'm saying so far, is that means that Lazarus Group was able to push to one of the most used interfaces for the Safe Wallet to anybody. They decided to pick Bybit because they knew it was probably one of the largest safe vaults. Mm-hmm. They pick Ethereum because Ethereum cannot be frozen. Right, so
USDT would not work, for instance.
USDC will have been frozen, right? So they pick something that could not be frozen, and then they would jump right away. Now, make no mistake, they could have target anyone else that was using Safe Wallet and was interacting with a Safe Wallet through the app.safe.global website.
Vitalik is using Safe Wallet.
Yes.
So Vitalik might have lost all his money.
Could have. In reality, that could have been the case.
But I think, like, from a perspective of potential attack vectors, is actually the best target was an exchange, because an exchange routinely does transactions.
Yes.
Routinely needs to do a multi-sig confirmation, rather than Vitalik, as last that I checked, didn't move his Ethereum from the Genesis block, actually, if I pretty much remember correctly.
And I think what it's important here, you know, because people will pick on the nuances here, and I think this is an important point. Safe Wallet is composed for three main things, right? Anton, you already put it very clear, right? So the centralized server, the systems that are helping aggregating the transactions, providing this nice UI. We have the smart contracts that we know we have been battle tested, that have been challenged multiple times. And then you have the application, the actual web app, right? So I recently published on LinkedIn a post that said, like, look, if you are interacting with Safe Wallet ecosystem by the smart contract directly, like you manage to deploy your own infrastructure, your own interaction, your own UI, you are, quote unquote, no pun intended, safe, right? Mm-hmm. Because the reality is that you're interacting with a smart contract. The smart contracts haven't changed in years, and you deploy your own systems, yeah, right? And you will have, you probably, hopefully, especially if you're managing billions, you have your own infrastructure, your own contracts, your own UI. And what I will expect, companies, exchanges, custodians to come out with and say, like, hey, we know about the Bybit hack. We know how it affected the supply chain was attacked on Safe. And I'm talking about supply chain being Safe part of the supply chain, not talking about, a supply chain attack per se, because I know some cybersecurity specialists are gonna point on that. But if you're interacting with a smart contract directly, you are good. If you're still using the centralized infrastructure, so they have gateways, APIs, whatever you're needed, then you're rolling the dice. I think they have said the safety came out very, very quickly. Lucas and team came and say, look, we run our own due diligence. We ensure there nothing like this happens. But, you are relying on a third party to do some important functions. That is still unlikely to be an attack vector. But again, it depends on what you're doing. If you are handling billions as a company, I think it might make sense to pull on something that it's on-premise or running your own thing. And the third party is, if you are still using the website, the appsafe.global, I mean, I think it's risky, because you have now verified, tested, executed attack. And this was a very complex, but once you have the blueprints on how to do that, now every organization that is interacting with Safe in this way has to wonder, is my own team not replicating this whole thing? Now you have a blueprint how exactly make an almost undistinguishable attack, right? So I think there are opportunities, and this is a critical time for the industry and a critical and a good chance for the Safe Wallet team to actually improve and increase their security models. But I mean, at the end of the day, it just highlights one of the saddest reality about the blockchain ecosystem. We still rely on centralized systems to interact with a decentralized world.
But the question is the following: if you receive the file and you have downloaded the file of any extension, why is the antivirus not picking the file? Why don't you have a system there that can know that this file is indeed malicious?
Right, Dimitri still hand up on the file one there. So most antiviruses will pick it up. The reality is, I think I wonder about that, because
what I'm trying to get is that, if Safe was hacked, is Safe's problem is not Bybit's problem. Because if there is a guy at Safe who is accepting files, and if for any reason Safe doesn't have the right set of controls to detect this kind of operation, then are they they should be the ultimate responsible people.
That is a good point. I think it's if you want to go into the technicality about who is at fault on the underlying hack, it is, let me put it this way.
Yes.
If we were into an enterprise relationship if there will be an enterprise relationship with a proper SLA, contractual agreement between Bybit and Safe, by all means, Safe will be completely at fault. The challenge here is that Safe is an open source, decentralized solution. They have a lot of disclaimers, right? When you use their solution, they say, like, look, we're not responsible for what you signed. We're a UI. We're helping you interact with a smart contract. But, and the last but not least is that the harsh reality is that there's one line of defense that Bybit could have used, which is use a different sort of wallet that could have transacted or processed that information or any other system, because I mean, now one of the things that came out is that, you know, out of the woodworks, there's a ton of solutions that say, oh, I could have stopped the Bybit attack, I could have done this, you had simulated. And some of those are true, but not all of them, right?
To maybe that, just to ask one more nuance, and then I hopefully we go to some more happier topics. But I'm very grateful that we're really decomposing this, because there's a lot of interest. So it's something very interesting you said. They actually targeted a person that had access to push code into production, right? So it's not in the UAT, it's not in the staging via testing, it's actually to production. How can you identify a person actually within an organization that has such rights and then target them? Because they could have targeted anyone else and then they're irrelevant. Even if they download a malicious executable file, nothing happens because they don't have the right access, right? But this was really fascinating when you told me just a second ago it was a person who had the rights to push code into production.
You're asking the right questions, Anton.
And I'm so happy to say that you say that.
Because I do think they struck gold. I don't think, this is how a lot of these attacks work, right? I mean, some of them are sophisticated, but I am pretty sure that they didn't think, A, they weren't going to succeed, B, to Dimitri's point, that they were going to go undetected, right? Because most organizations, I mean, I'm not even talking about, I mean, Dimitri, if you are working for a company, your computer is very likely to have antiviruses, they will have picked that up. They will have picked that up, right?
They should have picked
They should have that picked it up.
This is what worries me, actually.
For sure. So, again, it just speaks about the sort of controls and the sort of capacity. But again, I think hindsight is 20/20, right? We're always going to be like, say, look, but the reality is, as you know, maybe as a first learning experience, if you're working in an organization, if you're a CISO, cybersecurity expert, and you are still running an infrastructure of workstations without no supervision, no antiviruses, no managed endpoint controls, no CrowdStrike, no anything, this could be a very good case, particularly if you are actually running a crypto solution, right? But and to back to your question, I do think they just struck gold, right? So they just realized, first of all, they managed to get into an actual computer. Second, they managed to, you know, look at the files and they're like, we actually found an API key and they have been undetected. And then third part is like, this is the API key for the UI of the actual one of the largest. This is the thing. They probably, I mean, we don't know. I mean, Safe has yet to come with all the full forensics analysis of this. They probably had that for days, if not weeks, right? Mm. And they, I mean, I'm making that assumption, right? This is a speculation.
We speculate
right?
a lot on this podcast. All good.
just a disclaimer, right? But speculation wise, I think there's a very high chance they struck gold. I think will have been, they probably based, let me backtrack a little bit. I think based on the behavior the Lazarus Group has, they target as many organizations as possible. It's a spread and pray. And, you know, they target people on exchanges, they target people in custodians, in banks, in whatever thing that has crypto in it, you're going to get, you know, targeting one way or form, right? And the fact that they succeeded here probably opened, you know, a committee, a workshop group, I don't know how they're organized, that says like, hey, we got an API key, what do we do now? And very quickly, very likely, because they did not know how long they're going to have access to this API key, or this API key will have access to production, they very quickly put together an actual solution, or well, a script, I wouldn't call it a solution, they will put a hack in a script that will do and target the Bybit. The craziest part of, I mean, for me, the whole story is that they, in the code, in the script, the Bybit multisig wallet was hard-coded. So this was a deliberate attack. It's like this script could have been downloaded by thousands, you know, millions of people that use that website. But they deliberately target, this was a surgical attack into the Bybit exchange because they had the largest. Now, on full disclaimer, have to do it because, you know, might as well get on that. This could have happened to anybody. Yeah. This could have happened to anybody. Theirs is still, you go on chain, there's still tag on-chain exchanges that they have assets on the 9-10 digits that are holding by a Safe wallet.
And do you believe it's the Lazarus Group? Do you believe what the media are saying? This is the
I think so.
How do we know?
So good question, right? Because I have seen, and you know, this is speculation, right? Because it could have been an inside job, right? Could have seen that, you know, someone in Switzerland or Berlin or Germany was not getting paid enough, and they tell you like, hey, you know, just, you know, we'll send you whatever amount in crypto and then you will do that. We know that it was Lazarus Group. We perhaps might not know how much collaboration or inside attack could have been the case, but we know it was Lazarus Group because of the patterns that we see on chain. Mm-hmm. They replicate the same on-chain behaviors. They execute the same. Like that's kind of the thing. You know, we have in cybersecurity, it's kind of like, you know, if it walks like a dog, you know, it quacks like a dog. Yeah. It's a dog, right? So I think the good question where we want to, you know, go into speculation is, you know, how much help did Lazarus Group have, or how easy or how hard it is, right? So that is definitely speculation. I you know, it is hard for me to tell that, to say that. But what it is true is that it was them, and they are on the clock completely the entire day, have people that their full-time job 24/7 is finding vulnerabilities, new ways to clock. And that's why it could have been that they had probably could have targeted this, and maybe they had the script ready. Maybe they were like targeting the Safe Wallet for months, right? And then it just happened. We do not know to the extent of the work that they have done to actually achieve this.
Demetrios, one of the best things about Blockcast podcast is that we have leading experts like you, Jose, on our
very
show.
Kind.
And I have to say the rant was strong, same strong as our at our branch. So really thank you of that. But also to open up another amazing topic is you are a key person and leading one of the most respected custodians in the region and globally.
Thank you.
And I think for our audience and our viewers, maybe to also open up a discussion, what's the experience of leading Tungsten? And what are your plans? What have you been achievements? I wanted to also take this opportunity to congratulate you today on the news.
Thank you
that
very much.
ADGM, your regulator that's supervising you, approved the custody of Toncoin. But maybe that I don't spill all the beans, Dimitri, maybe I can pass the word to us. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
But yeah, please, wanted to also hear a bit about the amazing work you're doing with Tungsten. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Anton. I appreciate the kind words. So yes, I'm being privileged with the opportunity to lead Tungsten Custody Solutions, an Abu Dhabi qualified custodian regulated by the Abu Dhabi Global Market Financial Services Registry Authority, FSRA. And you know, to do the switch to the Bybit hack, our entire focus is pretty much keeping assets safe, right? There's many custodians in, you know, in the world, and you know that they actually had been operating for, you know, many years and many jurisdictions, but Tungsten is based in Abu Dhabi for one reason and one reason only. We have a strong belief there is a demand, and there will be a demand for digital assets to be on the balance chain, on the balance sheet of all MENA-based organizations. When you are seeing, when we think about a crypto, I know it's a meme about like, you know, we're still early, but we are, right? Yeah. You know, we really are. And when you are talking at the institutional level, I'm talking about, you know, the S&P 500. I'm talking about banks. I'm talking about large energy mining organizations, and they have to hedge their balance sheet. They have to identify what sort of opportunities. It will be silly to think that within the next 5 to 10 years, all of these organizations will not have some sort of digital asset on their balance sheet. And Tungsten was created because we believe also that building something from the ground up that is based in a particular region with a compliance and regulatory framework that organizations understand, respect, and know, will lead to a successful path of adoption of the crypto industry in this region.
I think you said it very well before that if you really want to work with large organizations or governments, you need to have local presence.
Sure.
And you guys are doing really, really good in that aspect. And actually, we want to to hear more a little bit. I mean, the audience, what is custody? Why is needed? Why we shouldn't do self-custody if we are big organizations nowadays? Maybe you can open a little bit the topic more.
Yes. Custody is a fascinating topic. A little bit, and I will jump on my background very quickly, right? But I've been working in the crypto industry for close to 7-8 years. And if you think about the crypto industry, the history, it became from a cyberpunk, from a libertarian point of view, right? It is digital money. But when you think about digital money, it has to be stored somewhere else, right? If you think about cash is physical, right? So you're going to store it, you know, under your mattress and your mattress and, you know, in a safe under within a drawer or whatever. But digital money is like, where do you put that, right? And the way digital money works is through digital tools. Now, the problem with digital tools is that it can be copied, it can be stolen, they can be, as we saw with the Bybit case, it can be tricked in some way or form. Now, when the movement started, this initial first of concept of storing these sort of assets, what we understand as custody, which we have done custody for generations within the financial traditional market, started with self-custody. That was the only thing you could do for the first miners of Bitcoin. They could just only, you know, plug their keys. They started a Bitcoin wallet that had its own private key. You get the 50 Bitcoin mining thingy. And yeah, because you started, I'm talking about, you know, some of the OGs that have been around. I mean, you were mining, you know, billions, but we'll understand now it's billion. But I mean, back in the day, it was peanuts, right? And you had this self-control. And this is what we understand about self-custody. Now, what started happening as those assets were increasing in value and people were getting exposed to, you know, sizable amount of money, people understood is the same way that why you go to a bank. You know, you can, I mean, I can probably put and store 1,000 dirham in my wallet and, you know, I'm safe. Now, if I have 500,000, might not be the best idea to put it into, you know, under a mattress, right? Because the exposure, the risk that I have from losing that amount of money is not necessarily that it's a lot, but the loss exposure that I might have from losing that is more significantly than if I lose $1,000, right? So it's very different, right? So what happened in the custody world is that once we got exposure, these assets blew up in value. Then they started popping up organizations that say, hey, I'm going to take care of that. You don't have to worry about the keys. You don't have to worry about the seeds, all these technicalities. And we're going to do that. And for the past, I think, 10 years, since the, you know, 12 years, 13 years that the blockchain ecosystem, particularly with Bitcoin pioneering, there's been all these custodians that are actually offering a service akin to a bank to take care of your crypto. That's a little bit of the coin. When we hear a custodian, what we do is actually we're hearing an institution that is being liable, that it is taking responsibility for taking care of your money and safekeeping it in multiple ways or form.
Can you, Jose, we know each other for, you mentioned this many years, and then I was reflecting actually how we know each other for a long time. Could you share a little bit about your journey in your career? We know each other from Switzerland, you know, from your glory days of Switzerland as well. How did that journey you're a CEO now of Tungsten. So from university, first job, being developing tools to becoming a CEO of a leading organization in the region and globally. How did that journey for you look like? You know, can you paint the picture a little bit?
Oh my God, it's it's been
we have hours, don't worry.
I always share that my origin story into the crypto and financial ecosystem started when I took a job originally from Mexico, in case the name was not always a giveaway. I always joke about that. And the name or the face. You know, I was doing a master's program in Canada, in Vancouver. And I remember that at a point of time, I was working for a small Swiss agency, and they were paying me to an American bank. And without boring you into the details, I didn't get access to my money. And at that point of time, you know, I was a broke student, my early 20s, so frustrated because for me, you know, $200 was, you know, whether I was going to eat or not, right? My debit card expired. I will moderate with the whole thing. But at that point, I realized, look, this whole banking stuff is broken. We need to do something else, right? And I then decided to relocate back to Switzerland. I didn't finish my master's. I relocated to Zurich, where I then proceeded to work for 12 years for multiple personal finance managers for multiple financial organizations. I did a tour in San Francisco because I wanted to see what the startup Silicon Valley ecosystem. At that point of time, I was working for Plaid, which I think it just, it's, you know,
an amazing company.
It's a great company, it's exactly great, right? Company. I think as of today, it's one of the best companies I ever worked with. William and Zach, you know, shout out. They have ballooned into success, into the hard work, and one of the great examples. I think Silicon Valley is still probably one of the best areas to build a company from a culture perspective, from an exposure to an idea and a vision. I think it's fantastic. But that's when I got actually into crypto. At that point of time, I opened, I think, a Coinbase account. I was buying, you know, Ethereum that it was like 1.5 bucks or something like that. I wish I had enabled the auto pay feature from Coinbase. I didn't.
I don't think there was the auto pay feature in the beginning.
I'm yeah, of sure. course. They didn't do anything, right?
Sure. I thought about that.
It was there in the beginning.
I would have loved to. But then I got into crypto and I supported a couple. I was involved in this whole ICO craze of 2018. I will then jump into another crypto company, HopperNet, which is still alive and strong. It was still based in the crypto valley, you know, and where all these crypto companies were working. And the common pattern that I saw in you know, during this thing is that everybody was doing self-custody. There was nothing, right? I mean, you had foundations that were raising millions, like 9-digit figures, and the way they were protecting those assets was like a bunch of nano ledgers and a, you know, Gnosis wallet, where back then it was a Gnosis wallet, right? Mm-hmm. And it was, to me, I mean, I actually operated treasury funds with like a nano ledger, and I always was, you know, it was just scary. It was just like, you know, I'm transferring, you know, 20 people's salary on a, you know, blockchain transaction. What is this, right? And I think after two or three organizations and, you know, aging a little bit, being exposed to that sort of fully decentralized, fully self-service, like there has to be something better. That's when I took a job at Seba Bank, which is now is known as Amina Bank.
One of the world's first, or the first, together with Signum, licensed bank, actually. Yes. Yeah. So congratulations on that achievement as well.
Thank you. that was great. A big shout out to the Amina Bank now, the team. So we're, I think it was a part of whoever you want to ask who was the first Swiss crypto bank regulated, but they were definitely up there. And that allowed me to learn how institutional custody works. And, you know, on that role, I was very lucky to engage. That's what the, you know, for the very first time, I engaged with institutional players. I learned how to deploy, you know, solutions, infrastructure on the cold setup, deep cold, hot wallets, institutional wallets. It was fascinating learning about, you know, how do you take care of billions worth of money? You know, I mean, self-custody, I mean, sure, I'll take care of, you know, the $1,000 that I have in whatever meme coin that I'm deploying last week. But we're talking about other people's money. You need to have a completely different set of controls, right? And, you know, I was very lucky to have that experience. That's when I, you know, I managed to meet very technical savvy teams, the teams of Farblocks, you know, Taurus, the Medica of the worlds. And at that point of time, I was, you know, very, very lucky to have that opportunity. But, you know, I'm a happily married man, and my wife, who managed to join me in that journey of Switzerland after 4 years, told me like, look, Switzerland is nice and everything, but let's go to a place that is less cold, right?
So and it was the weather that the move.
I still miss Switzerland. I love Switzerland. I've been there multiple times. I hope that I come back again summer this year. But it was just I was both a mix of weather, you know, family changing, and you know, some personal preferences. And at that point of that, actually, we thought about going back to Mexico, and then out of nowhere, a message came from Abu Dhabi
on LinkedIn with a PDF file to download.
Just asking. Anton, I was going to ask the same question. Yeah.
There you go. It was no PDF, but it was a message from LinkedIn. Yes, yeah. It was true. I got approached by the partners, by John, one of the partners from Further Ventures, one of the largest venture funds here in Abu Dhabi, backed by with LPs of the likes of MasterCard and ADQ.
We really like Further Ventures for the audience.
Yes. Very strong, actually.
Yes, a wonderful team, very capable, extremely hands-on team of investment. You know, I've worked with investors in many regions, but you know, Faisal Hamdi and the Further Ventures team are incredible, hands-on, interactive, operative sort of individuals that they care a lot about the companies and the portfolio companies they invest in. So they reach out. They were pretty much building Tungsten at this point of time, but they were looking for a co-founder, for someone that kind of was able to take this sort of technical approach. My profile drew their attention. I actually flew here to Abu Dhabi. My wife was, you know, was like completely like, "What are you doing?" You know, and then like I came here, staying a couple of days, and I was like, "Yeah, I don't know," you know, like I just want to give it a try. And when I met the team, and when I met, you know, saw their offices, saw what they were building, the ecosystem, and what it was actually happening in Abu Dhabi, it was just very easy. It was just like, look, we can go back to Mexico and, you know, identify what multiple opportunities going on there, or, you know, perhaps explore North America. But the place to be and the place what I knew I had to be to build the next thing in crypto was Abu Dhabi. No questions asked. We pack our things. 3 months later, I relocated my beautiful wife and two kids to Abu Dhabi. And well, we had been living here. We crossed the mark 1 year a couple of days ago. Oh, wow. So it's been fantastic. To my second Ramadan. So.
I wanted to ask a little bit about Further Ventures. So when you're in the ecosystem of Further Ventures, are you able to collaborate with the other companies that Further Ventures is investing in? Do you have like a sort of a panel or a sort of a meeting that you all are in this eco-friendly space?
Yes. I think the benefit of Further Ventures group is twofold. So the first one is the network of individuals, companies, enterprises we get access through the very high reputation the entity, the firm, the individuals behind this have is immense. Like, I do not know. I know there's other players in the region. I'm not trying to throw shade, but I really admire, you know, organizations that come here on their own and, you know, knock the doors and do their sales, because it is tough, right? You know, you're coming into a growing market, but everybody is, you know, the Middle East is booming. The UAE is growing probably the fastest of everyone else. So you're going to have new players coming, but then it's kind of like, you know, a free for all, right? The fact that we have the backing, they have the fact that we have, that we're able to latch is not the right word, but that we're able to ride on the reputation and to be able to ride on pretty much the network that the Further Ventures has provided us, it gives us an advantage. It just gives us no questions asked. It gives us a competitive edge over anyone else because they know we have their support. We have their supervision. You can imagine, you know, I have tough board meetings sometimes. It's not always easy to navigate to the dynamics of a company with you know such a strong reputation, but at the same time it definitely helps to push a product and a company to the front. And the second part is, of course, we engage with other portfolio companies. I'm very happy to share that, you know, one of our clients is you know supporting the WIO Bank through Fuse Finance, one of the largest OTC trading desk in the region. We are able to support in multiple capacities some of the exercises and some of the developments that are going in the digital asset industry through some of these organizations. We are relying, for instance, in DFNS or defense as they are their call, which is a key management solution that we are deploying to be able to handle part of our cryptographic materials that Further Ventures lead the latest round of investments. You know, we are working with multiple of these portfolio companies. Sometimes they also help us keep us real. You know, we know that, you know, everybody wants to get a good deal and everybody wants to get everybody's trying to make money and, you know, try to get a good revenue of their services. But we also try to be whenever possible, whenever our margins allow to, you know, provide a strong solution that everybody benefits from.
Yes. Very fascinating journey that you have and that Tungsten has had. And maybe to ask you a question on a bit of a personal basis, which we touched upon in our now famous branch that I'm mentioning for a couple of times. How is the position, the job, the responsibility of a CEO is different than when you're on the technical side? How? Yes. Yeah. So give a bit of flavor to the audience, because I'm sure many of our subscribers or people who watch our podcast are very much on the technical side. And I'm sure many of them are wondering, how do I become like Jose?
You're too kind, Anton, but I do definitely think that I would like to share that, because when you are on the technical side, right? And, you know, full disclosure, being technical, have 12 years plus of technical engineer background, bachelor in computer science, have led teams, build systems, you know, the whole shebang. I know AI is you know, coming for jobs, but I still have a true love and appreciation for the craft of software engineering. But when you are in that, in the benefit or sort of the advantage of being in that role is that for better words, you don't have to worry about the complexity of running the business. Mm-hmm. You have to worry about keeping systems alive, making a good solution. You take care about your users, you take care about the infrastructure, but more often than not, you don't necessarily take look into kind of like, you know, the P&L, the profit and loss of an organization, right? That is just, you know, one of the benefits, right? And for a lot of very skilled engineers that, you know, still run some of the most complex systems in the world, sorry, this is a very profitable career. They never have to go to a, you know, stakeholders meeting. They
board meetings.
No meetings, right? I mean, no board meeting, no anything like that, right? And you know, if you're very good in your craft and you're among the very best, and this is something you're passionate, you're good at, please carry on. Now, when you take into, a lot of people tell you like, okay, what does it mean into a CEO? The reality is that you're put into a blender where every single touch point of your company, you need to be on top. Mm. You need to be on top of the legalities of your organization. You need to be on top of your sales pipeline. You need to be on top of your financial budget. You need to be on top of the HR capability. You need to be on compliance and regulation. And you need to be on top of everything. In addition to, of course, being aware of how the company has been run from an operation, technology, you know, added value, supply chain, the whole thing, right? That is the part that I think sometimes it's, you know, I was joking on LinkedIn the other day. It's like a lot of people, you know, maybe my head of engineer was joking today, you know, the only thing you do is appear in podcasts and now showing up in TV news and, you know, write nice posts on LinkedIn, right? And it's like, yeah, you know, I'll happily give you the suit for a day. And you tell me how it goes, right?
I really want to ask you a funny question. Does your family understand what you do?
or does it now understand better, or when you were on the technical side and less?
That is true. I think one of the benefits is that now they know what I do. Okay. I think it's a CEO, it's you know, people saying like, oh, you know, you're the CEO of a company, and you know, people have more familiarity when you're on the technical side. You know, my brothers, my mom will still like, yeah, you know, he's good with computers, right? And I was like,
he fixes the computers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. When the Wi-Fi is down, just bring Jose, right? And he's like, all right, fine, I'll take it. And, you know, a CEO is kind of like, you know, very visible, very outgoing, but it goes with the same responsibilities, right? It's like, you know, I now represent, I have a, you know, in some way or form represent Tungsten in multiple capacities. I am a proof individual for the regulator, right? If you see about the Abu Dhabi regulation, you need to be an approved individual that it's able to represent the company under regulatory compliance. Multiple, I am behind the complexities of if there's any point of time money laundering conflicts in the organization, I am liable in some way or form. So these are challenging things that it comes with a job. Now, it is definitely you know, a funny thing because, you know, I love my wife, and you know, before she was, when I was on the whole blockchain engineer, she's like, yeah, he's just, you know, coding and stuff. And, you know, I think I have became more attractive now that I'm able to switch the suit for the t-shirts for the suits.
Yes. So, Jose, really one of our key goals at Blockcast Podcast is to bring exceptional people. And listening to your story, I have to say congratulations on everything you have achieved.
Thank you.
It's really also to been a pleasure to know you for so many years. And also really appreciate that you dissected the Bybit hack. Yes. And also, I think that was really fascinating.
Anton, we really wanted to bring someone that can explain it in the micro details.
Yes, yeah. And I think we have achieved that, yeah. But also, I think maybe one of the last points we wanted to get out of you is, how does the future look like for Jose? How does it look like for Tungsten? What do you see for the future of the region and globally? paint us a picture a little bit. How does that look like? Maybe starting from yourself, Tanks, or however you want, whatever you prefer.
I'll get it started on my end. What it's starting for Jose is still a lot of meetings, a lot of podcasts, a lot of LinkedIn posts. But no, but jokes aside, it's a lot of driving and you know, working with a very qualified team. This is by no means a single individual effort. I am surrounded by incredible, capable team members that are able to run the company and build a fantastic product that I'm extremely proud of, and that I am on a daily basis touching point with them and working to build in a system. That sometimes the reality as a CEO, and particularly in this region, which is highly demanding, is extremely high performance driven. It involves a lot of work. I wouldn't be able to do it without the love and support of my wife and my family. A third shout out to my to my lovely, beautiful wife. That it's, you know, holding the fort whenever I come back late to the meetings. You know, you can imagine sometimes, you know, come back like 10, 11 a.m. from Abu Dhabi. 11 p.m. And, you know, my wife takes care of you know, or two beautiful girls. And, you know, she's always there with a smile. She has gone through multiple challenges and hardships that I completely admire her. And that, you know, being next to me is, I couldn't be, you know, happier and feel more blessed. But
shout out to the wives and girlfriends of CEOs and founders.
That is true, right? I'll double click on that. You give me the entry, right? But it's true. A lot of people think it's a single person effort. Like, I wouldn't do anything. I will not have achieved my one final shout out. As I mentioned, originally from Mexico, was in Switzerland. I started dating my wife when I was already in Switzerland. She was in Mexico. She had no business whatsoever in Switzerland. We got married. She followed me over to Switzerland, and now she followed me to the UAE. I have nothing but thankful words for her and the work that she's doing. And you know, because otherwise, you know, I'll bore the audience with my love story. But the whole point is that after that, you know, after that CEO responsibility, what that results into Tongsen is, we're very focused into building the best qualified custodian into the region, the most secure and the most capable one. Security, I keep hearing the commoditization of custodians, no charging on basis point, it should be free, everybody can create a wallet. Everybody can create a wallet, not everybody can secure it. We want to make sure that our clients know something like Bybit will never happen to us, and that we are putting above and beyond amount of resources, knowledge, intellect, and experience to provide the best guarantee for the institutions, for the individuals, for the companies that are actually putting their money in one of the most innovative asset classes in the history of the humankind, that they will know that at least their hard-earned money will be taken care of. This is the most important thing about Tongsen. We are slowly increasing the capacity, and that means usually listing new tokens like Tong Foundation, the Tong Network, the Open Network token, that it's you know, one of the most used network used tokens in the region, supported by Telegram, one of the most growing communications applications, mobile applications that are out there. It means providing a set of a range of products. We also want to increase the exposure of traditional financial instruments into the enterprises. So a lot of people think like, okay, when is, you know, the institution going to crypto? And I often ask people, is like, well, when is crypto coming to the institution? Mm-hmm. So what are we doing as an industry to make sure that, you know, large institutions can actually use crypto, right? I mean, we saw Mubadala just deploying $437 million. To an ETF, right? Yes. And this is a win for the industry, right? I mean, I get it. I would have loved that they will have instead deploy that money to Tongsen, but they are getting their hands into the actual ecosystem. How many organizations, how many jurisdictions can say that they have sovereign wealth funds actually being deployed 9 digits plus into Bitcoin? You know, well, I mean, yes, we see the US is getting there, is announcing there, is...
I think the US is getting there, and we're pretty happy that this big change has happened. But Anton was ready for this a while ago. You were sure that this will happen.
I was very optimistic, you know, about the region and about what's happening globally. I think that we are very blessed to be in this industry.
Yes.
And really to repeat, Jose, something that you said, we are still early. You can say fortunately or unfortunately, it's always two sides to that coin. But I really do feel that we are early.
But even for America, you told me that when this new administration will win...
I try not to be political at the podcast, but indeed I did.
A lot of beautiful things will happen America and in the region.
Yeah, I was very bullish on it. And I think it just shows that we're in the right place. We're in the right industry. And I'm very happy to be part of, you know, the ecosystem, part of to be a fine group of people like Demetrios, you, like you, Jose, you as well. And I feel that this is becoming the go-to place. For instance, very soon we'll have Token 2049. I think the whole world will collide.
Maybe let's ask Jose what is his
plans. Ah, sorry, Jose, what are your plans? Where can people meet you? I know that we are fortunate to access you easily through a message, but how can...
I was going to ask the other one. Will we be invited again for further ventures? Abu Dhabi?
yes, we're...
For
public,
sure.
Public pressure now.
Sorry, I'll make sure that...
It was one of the best events.
Finest events, yeah, yes. True.
Thank you so much. The Further Ventures group are amazing. Yeah. And I think they during the Abu Dhabi Finance Week, they probably organized one of the biggest, if not the highest quality events. So,
yes.
Jose, just to ask you, do you plan something to do in Token 2049, especially for you as leading the Tungsten? What other events? Where can we see you? How can people access you? In person, please.
Yes. Please reach out through LinkedIn. No.
with a PDF.
With a PDF. No. So first of all, we have our offices. I always invite, we're very proud to be based in the region and working in the region. Anybody can feel free to say hi. We're in Tamu Tower by Rim, floor 17. Please come by and say hi any point of time. I mean, if you give us a heads up, that will be great. But you also, please come. This region, pioneered by hospitality. Yes. A good friend, I remember, said that, you know, the UAE is a home for everybody. So I extend that flexibility to anybody that's within the region. I spend some time in Dubai, Thursday, Fridays. I try to, you know, there's a very World Trade Center downtown. You know, there's a strong community around one central area. And, you know, usually there's many events that are available there. IB team is actually has offices there here in Dubai, and you know that I'm reachable as much as possible. Tungsten, of course, we have a website. If you want to learn more about Tungsten, tungsten.ae, we have a contact form in case of you want to learn about more about our services. But I mentioned, you know, you can reach out multiple ways.
Which event you will be going until the end of the year? Will you make it to Token 2049?
We'll be present in Token 2049. We'll have our own event. We're doing an event with other partners in addition to the Further Ventures event. So we're going to be very happy to extend invitations to our good partners.
I haven't received the email so far, so, but no, hopefully.
You will remind me the first thing that I do after I finish. I'll send you.
From LinkedIn for sure.
LinkedIn. Oh my God. We're giving so much free traffic to LinkedIn. Yes. It's crazy. No, but we are definitely doing Token 2049. This is going to be probably the biggest event within the region.
Yes.
The region slimmed down a little bit over summer. I will say, you know, when May, June, probably things will slow down. But if anybody has a chance to come or are thinking about, you know, exploring, identify, getting the vibe about what's going on in the region, I would recommend Token 2049. I cannot make any promises, but hopefully it will not rain and flood like it did last year.
I think we should be fine.
You should be fine.
But and you know, Demetrios, to your previous point about the US, right? I have so many friends and connections in the US.
So are you going to Las Vegas?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
For the conference.
Are you going to Las Vegas for one of the biggest conferences in the world?
I think after three compliments to my wife, maybe I can. I can get
what
a
good strategy.
What is it for Bitcoin Las Vegas?
Something like that.
Bitcoin Las Vegas. Yeah. And the Bitcoin Media conference was amazing.
It was very nice.
Eric Tron was here. Yes. You know, we got many of the big players actually coming here. We are very excited. This region, and I know we want to get political, but this region, the amount of partnerships, you will be surprised about the strong relationship the UAE has with the US.
Yes.
The amount of capital, interaction, development, research, and capabilities that are being deployed between the US and the UAE is fantastic. It's probably one of the best friendships that I've seen. I've been very lucky to have been invited to some of the US-UAE business council meetings that, you know, we had visitors, a delegation from Michigan. Marco Rubio was here, the Secretary of the State. It's amazing to be able to have access as a country to some of the largest potentials in the world, right? And I think the UAE is doing exactly the right strategy. It's showing interest, it's showing respect, it's showing capability to develop something, and it's the ability to actually invite people to build something together. I think that is the way the world's going. I know right now it's a hot topic because there are some fortunate, you know, events going around the world, and everybody can take a stand about the current administration. What I think, you know, I don't care much about the politicians. You can imagine myself as Mexican. I have my own opinions. But the reality is that I'm extremely optimistic for the crypto industry and what the UAE and alliance with the US is currently doing for everybody involved in the ecosystem.
I have to say that today we had a very multidimensional discussion. So we started off very strong with the Bybit hack. We learned a lot about your experience about leading Tungsten from being more on the technical side, now being as a CEO. Really appreciate your thoughts on the future, what's happening here, about the global geopolitical crypto situation, you know. And I really want to say I'm very grateful for today's podcast. It was really excellent.
Thank you.
Great
so much.
Vibe as well. I have to say, you know, really, really great vibe. Maybe it coincides with the Ramadan as well.
Yes, there you
could
go.
Be where it's much more relaxed and peaceful. So from my side, really wanted to thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you for your friendship. And thank you for being a valued guest on our podcast. Demetrios would also pass the word to you.
I think the conversation was very, very interesting. And we're really happy to bring you here today because we were looking for someone that really understands hack from the business side, not just from the technological side. And the other thing I admire about you is that you're also spreading this openness of the region. So you want to meet people, you want to network. And I believe one of our mission here in the podcast is to meet people and also have very good connections in the region. So it's to help and to make sure that we can help companies to grow by our little network that we're building with Anton here.
Slowly.
So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. Thank you so much for allowing me to share part of my experience and, you know, be able to dissect some of the most interesting topics that are going into the industry. I am flattered. I'm very thankful for your friendship, Anton, as well. I'm pretty sure we're going to grow more friendship in the further adventure, Metro. So yeah, for now, we're going to increase the the pressure there. And it's a pleasure to be, and I'm honored. If anything, I'm extremely thankful of all the, you know, all the blessings that I have. I think it's very in conjunction to the timing, that Ramadan being a time of reflection. I'm very grateful of the opportunity that I have to be able to expose to multiple skill and you know, capable individuals, starting with you both gentlemen. So you know, shukran.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the audience. Wishing you Ramadan Karim. And
Ramadan
see you
Karim.
Soon. Ramadan Karim.
Ramadan Karim.